Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. February 12th was the 209th anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin, the father of the theory of evolution. Over the last couple of decades, there's been a movement afoot to establish an International Darwin Day that would be celebrated around the world, and that movement is growing. There are groups all over the world who've been organizing annual Darwin Day celebrations. One of those groups is in Iowa City, where Darwin Day will be celebrated this Friday and Saturday, February 23rd and 24th. Iowa City Darwin Day is bringing scientists from near and far to share some of their knowledge. And my first guest today is a paleoecologist and biogeographer. She studies the climate-driven extinctions of the past and climate change here and now. Jacqueline Gill is an assistant professor at the University of Maine Climate Change Institute. She also co-hosts a podcast called Warm Regards. Hello, Jacqueline.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. Now, your presentations at Darwin Day will focus on your work, and the talk that you're giving for scientists is The Past is Not Dead, How the Last 2.5 Million Years of Global Change Can Prepare Us for the Next Century. Your talk for the public is Of Mice and Mammoths, Ice Age Perspectives on Extinction, Survival, and Resilience. So you'll be focusing on the work that you do. What can we learn from studying ice age extinctions when we're looking forward to the future?
Such a great question. So even though I spend a tremendous amount of time, you know, playing in the mud and digging up old plant and animal remains, I'm very much rooted in the present and thinking about the immediate concerns facing our species in the near future. And so one thing I like to think about is how, you know, when we want to understand how our species and how our ecological communities will respond to things like climate change or extinction in the future, we have this tremendous archive of these so-called natural experiments in the past. So there have been times when species have gone extinct. We can sort of look at what happens to the rest of the ecosystem. So I often ask the question, you know, what do we lose from an ecosystem when we lose a woolly mammoth? And maybe that will help us to understand what we might lose from an ecosystem if we were to, say, lose an elephant. We also have these examples from the recent fossil record of very abrupt warming events or other kinds of climate changes. And looking at how, say, trees or other species might have responded to those events will kind of help us to get a better sense of what might happen in the near future.
Well, those warming events or sudden episodes of climate change were natural, and we're dealing with climate change that is largely man-made. Doesn't that change factors that go into how this is working?
Oh, absolutely. So one thing to think about is that in some of these cases, the causes of these climate events don't necessarily matter to the species experiencing them. And so the rate of climate change that's coming in the next century and the magnitude, so how fast and how much, certainly matters to species. And so if we can look into the past and find some events that are very similar in terms of how fast and how much climate change we expect, those can actually be useful analogs. Of course, there are a lot of other things that are quite different about the present compared with the Ice Age past. So we didn't have parking lots and large areas of farmlands or pollution or widespread overhunting or exploitation of species. And so not all the rules are the same between the sort of Ice Age ecosystems and today. But we can still use these natural experiments to get some sense of the range of possible responses. And what I like about that is that there are so many millions of species that many of us scientists are concerned about going into the next century. And if I can use the Ice Age to provide some context that some species might be okay, some ecosystems might be okay, while others might be at greater risk, that allows me to narrow down and focus our limited conservation dollars and effort on sort of a kind of triage to really get a sense of which of our ecological communities do we really need to focus the most on.
Well, I was just going to ask you, you mentioned the mammoth, and maybe by understanding how losing the mammoth changed the ecosystem, we can understand how losing the elephant might change our ecosystem. But the magnitude of that loss is so great. I mean, what do we gain by understanding how that would affect the ecosystem when, I mean, right now people are working so hard just to prevent it from happening?
So there are, I think, some lessons that we can draw from the past. For example, some of the work that I've done on the Ice Age ecosystems of North America, you know, just down the road in places like Indiana, Ohio, Minnesota, we find that when we lose these large animals, we actually undermine the resilience of the surviving community. And what we're learning that these really big animals often have a disproportionate influence on their ecosystem relative to how abundant they are. And we talk about these so-called keystone species. We often see other animals like elephants or rhinoceros, or even in some cases moose or bison, as also being keystones. And so getting some sense of just how vulnerable these animals might be to extinction, but also what we lose, the kinds of ecosystem services that we might lose when we lose these big animals, is really important. And so even though the scale is smaller, we certainly live in a smaller world when it comes to our animals than say, an Ice Age landscape, we can still kind of draw some analogs that will help us to protect the Ice Age survivors. And one thing I should also add is that there's a tremendous focus on extinction, but the Ice Age also has incredible stories of survival and resilience, and that gives me a lot of hope as an ecologist, and that's something that I'll be talking about in my public talk.
Now, in addition to your work as a scientist, you have also taken on a public role as someone who communicates with the public about science and also an activist as well. You were one of the founders of the March for Science, which took place just a little under a year ago. I'm curious. I mean, I can imagine that you might have some conflicting feelings about taking on that role. What makes it important to you to be public about what you're doing and why you feel it's important?
Well, I feel very strongly about this because I went to graduate school at the University of Wisconsin. Now I'm at the University of Maine. Both of those are public land-grant institutions, and my research is funded by taxpayers. I wouldn't have been able to go to school to college if it weren't for the support of tax dollars. And so I feel very strongly that I have a duty to give back to the community, to make my science accessible to every American. I feel very strongly about what I call science for everyone. So that's the idea that science should be done in the public interest. It should be accessible, easily communicated to every American, and also that the pathways to science should be available to anyone who wants to pursue them. So as a woman in science, for example, you know, I often run across some of the barriers to improving diversity in my field, and anything that we can do to increase the visibility of women scientists helps widen the path for those that come behind us. So there are lots of reasons why our science should be accessible and, you know, communicated effectively to others, and why we should be visible, why we should be solving real-world problems. I don't really see any drawbacks to that other than, you know, sometimes there are risks associated with having a voice and using it and speaking out. Sometimes people are concerned that being an advocate means that you're not an honest broker as a scientist, you know, that you're sort of creating this, or you're muddying the water, so to speak, between, you know, the more empirical and objective research versus, you know, the opinions that you have. But I really just feel like what it does is it makes me more transparent and accessible to the communities that are funding and supporting this research. And I feel that it's my duty to make that whole process of science as open and transparent as possible.
You interview a number of other scientists on your podcast. I'm sure you interact with other scientists a lot. Are there ever conversations in the scientific community about people feeling like it's unfair that scientists now have to also carry this mantle of needing to convince people that what they're doing is real and true. I can imagine when many scientists went into their field, that was really the last thing on their minds.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because many of us as scientists now, we have to take on all of these extra roles. And, you know, sometimes we're not necessarily trained in how to be effective communicators, or we're not necessarily trained in how to do policy. And we often have a kind of crash course in all of those things when we, you know, when we get our jobs and we start to engage. I think for many of us, though, the real despair comes, or the frustrations, I should say, come from trying, you know, the realization that there are people who don't even believe that what you do is real, as you said, right? That, you know, I became a scientist because I wanted to do the most good that I could. And to struggle with the sense of helplessness as I see support for public funding of science eroding has been really frustrating because, again, for me, it all comes back to this idea of science for everyone. And the more accessible and transparent we can make science, you know, the better for everybody. And so, you know, many of my colleagues, I think, we're struggling with how to improve the messaging, right? Because oftentimes science has a PR problem in terms of really just communicating exactly what the benefits are of what we do to everybody. But the March for Science actually gave me a tremendous amount of hope because there was this massive public outpour of support for science. And a lot of folks, I think, who are not scientists are realizing just how science is done in this country, how it's funded, how our scientific agencies serve all Americans. And the broader culture of science and science communication, I think, is benefiting from the kinds of conversations that we're having now for the first time. And so there have been some growing pains, and certainly it's frustrating to face issues like the government muzzling of scientists. But in the end, I maintain a lot of hope because I see this tremendous public support for science overall, and that's what gets me through the day.
Well, Jacqueline Gill, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
Jacqueline Gill is an assistant professor at the University of Maine Climate Change Institute. She also co-hosts a podcast called Warm Regards. She'll be speaking at Iowa City Darwin Day coming up this Friday and Saturday, February 23rd and 24th. We'll continue our conversations about Darwin Day in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowa City's Darwin Day celebration is coming up this Friday and Saturday, February 23rd and 24th. It's a celebration of science and its contributions to humanity. And my next guests will be giving presentations that focus on working with young people. Paul Strode is a high school science teacher in Boulder, Colorado. He has a PhD in ecology and evolution. He'll be giving a talk called Teaching Students to Think Like Scientists, and also leading a workshop for teachers. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Of course.
Now, I've been looking through a lot of your blog posts. You seem to have some very strong feelings about how science should be approached in a high school classroom, and those thoughts don't necessarily line up with the status quo. So tell me a little bit about your approach to teaching science.
Well, my approach, I think, hopefully, is as a scientist. And with the experience I got in graduate school, doing real science, of course, I brought that to teaching. And I guess I work with my students to, as the title of my talk is, think like scientists, to look at their data dispassionately, but still be passionate about the work, to think critically about claims, to bring evidence to their reasoning, just all of the good science practices.
So in the classroom, do you try to take a more hands-on approach than the textbook heavy learning that a lot of us experienced when we were in high school?
Oh, absolutely. The textbook in my classroom is used more as a resource. And I try and approach their learning through inquiry. And I teach biology, which makes it, really easy to do lots of inquiry and to do lots of extended experiences. And so instead of doing these short, 50-minute cookbook labs that a lot of us had when we were younger, I try and do things that are a little bit more open-ended, where I'm not quite sure what the students will get. And so an example of that is an activity we do in the fall where they're outside and they set up these little pitfall traps for whatever's crawling around. And we set up traps along an edge of a grassy area and then in the interior of it, and every year it's a little bit different what they collect.
In teaching students to think like scientists, you're also hoping to, as you said, help them take a more critical eye to claims that they see being made. Explain that part of it. What are you trying to help students do?
Well, I'm trying to help them think away from what we are seeing on social media, and to take those claims and put them to the test, and also to know where to find the good information, the information that has been vetted by peer review, and be able to interpret that and understand it. So we do a lot of work with reading and interpreting scientific papers. My courses have a pretty heavy statistics curriculum that weaves throughout. And so, we say in biology that nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution, but I also think nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of the language of science, which is statistics.
You also de-emphasize grades, at least the traditional kinds of grading systems that most of us are familiar with. Why is that an important part of the approach?
Well, so there's a couple of reasons. One is I think that points get in the way of learning and understanding, because students tend to focus on accumulating as big of a pile of points as they can during a semester or a year, and what gets lost is just the actual learning process and understanding the material and revisions and progress. And so I say to my students and my parents that my classes are pointless, which in fact literally they are. And so students then make grade claims at the end of the semester. So the grade isn't something that they're focusing on. They're focusing on progress. So that's the whole de-emphasis on grades thing. And it's not something that I started. It's something that is kind of a bit of a national movement, but I was introduced to it by my wife, who teaches language arts here, who's been de-emphasizing grades and points for several years.
Well, Paul, stay with us. I'm talking with Paul Strode. He's a high school science teacher in Boulder, Colorado. I also want to bring somebody else into the conversation who will also be at Darwin Day. Jim Hansen is former director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. He's now an adjunct professor directing the program on climate science awareness and solutions of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. He'll be giving two talks for the scientists, energy, climate, and policies, risks, and opportunities for the public, young people's birth. Burden, averting climate disaster. Hello, Jim.
Hi.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Jim, you feel like it's time we stop debating climate change. What should we be talking about? What should the national conversation be about at this moment?
Well, yeah, the climate change is now, very obvious. the thing that we need to focus on is what we should be doing about it. And in fact, making clear that the things that we need to do actually make sense for other reasons. They make a good economic sense. It's the only way that we can be fair to young people is to begin to look at what the implications are of our energy policies. So we need to stop pretending that we don't understand that. And the point is, we're going to have to move to clean energies. And that's actually not that difficult if we would simply make the price of fossil fuels honest by including their cost to society. And if you do this in a gradual way, it actually makes sense. It moves us toward technologies of the future, clean energy technologies, but does it in a way that's economically sensible and replaces our aging infrastructure with modern future infrastructure, and would allow, in the case of the United States, allow us to be technological leaders for the future. So there's absolutely no reason not to do it, except that the fossil fuel industry is enormously powerful. And it influences both political parties in the United States, such that we're just not doing what makes sense for young people. So they need to understand that. Young people need to understand that and demand the changes that are needed. And they have the power to do that.
When you talk about this being young people's, well, you call it young people's burden, but also their responsibility, do you feel like the older generations have already failed at this?
Well, yeah, we certainly have. We're, in some sense, going backwards over the last several years. We had Obama in office for 8 years, and he had said on the campaign trail that we have a planet in peril, and he would take the actions to deal with that. Well, he took, half-hearted actions like trying to close down some coal plants in a way that then can be reversed, and which is very ineffectual. We actually have to move to clean energies on a global scale.
Well, and Paul, I want to turn back to you. As a high school teacher, so much of what our young people are learning about science today and learning about current events in science together is really, really scary. When, we talk about climate change and we look at mass extinction and a lot of the really troubling things that are happening on our planet right now, how do your students respond to that?
Well, one way they respond is actually by starting to get interested in things like environmental science in college and the climate sciences. The things that we talk about in class, the discussions we have, I think these kids in their intellectual development are primed to become really passionate about these issues. And so we do have opportunities to help them move in particular directions as far as their careers go. Unfortunately, I have no way to track all of my students and find out where they end up. But my hope is if they don't end up in the sciences, at least what I do know is that they're going to end up as voters.
Do you fear that your students will get discouraged? I mean, the enormity of the problems we're facing can feel very discouraging. I mean, I know people that just kind of shut down in the face of them. How do you communicate with your students in a way that they feel like maybe they have some hope to address these issues?
Well, I encourage them to look at these things as opportunities. Humans, we're great at problem solving. And so here's another problem that, of course, unfortunately, we have created, and so it's a problem that needs to be solved. And it is daunting, and it can be really depressing. But you know, Jim and I grew up in the nuclear arms race age, and we may in fact be back in that now. But it was pretty daunting and depressing. But we, you know, came out of it, I think, pretty inspired to do good work in science. And so I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful and optimistic for these kids.
How about you, Jim? When you look at the future,
yeah.
I mean, it sounds like you've given up on today's political power structure. What do you feel optimistic when you look at the future?
Yeah, I do. And in fact, we have the potential with our technology, and especially with the universities in the United States. We have the best country for being innovative, because of our democratic system and because of our good universities. And if we can just get them directed, I'm optimistic that we could deal with this problem. I was interested by the fact that one University of Iowa student sent me an email a few weeks ago and asked if he could meet with me when I'm in Iowa City next week, because he's very interested in molten salt reactors, a new kind of technology for nuclear power. And that's an example of the kind of thing where our government has really failed us. We have not done the research and development on advanced generation safe nuclear power, and instead gambled everything on windmills and solar panels. And renewable energies are certainly part of the energy solution, but unlikely to be a complete solution. And I also got a recent email from students at Iowa State on the same topic. So that's where we need to take advantage of our potential for innovations for the future.
So when people listen to your talk about young people's burden averting climate disaster, what do you want people to take away from that when they walk out the room? I mean, clearly you're trying to inspire action.
Yeah, well, young people need to understand, and older people need to help them with the political process, because what's happened then is our democracy has problems right now. We've got two parties. It's become a case of tribalism, where the extreme elements in the two parties have essentially taken over, and we've got a situation where the media just focuses on these two extremes. On the one side, you get the Fox News and the extreme right wing, and then you turn on the other channels and you get just fighting that other extreme. So one of the things that I frankly think is that we need a third party. I say we need to make America America again, and that requires being scientific, frankly, and being objective, and I think the solutions are more in the middle ground, where we can talk to each other and be rational about what's needed. It is complicated in the sense that we're talking not just about science, but about social science and about politics. But it's not enough for young people to just say, oh, please address the climate problem. They actually have to look at it and understand what is needed and what the implications are for the energy system and the need for innovations.
Well, Paul, I'll let you have the last word here. Teaching your students to think like scientists, are you hoping that maybe crosses over into other areas of their life as well, not just teaching them to think like scientists, but teaching them to be critical thinkers in all areas.
Oh, absolutely. I think that one thing that I try and get my students to be aware of is confirmation bias and motivated reasoning, where, you know, you have what you hope to be true, and then you have what the data say and what actually might be going on. And I mentioned earlier this idea of being dispassionate. It's really important that that we, and as Jim mentioned, be objective about the science, and try and keep our hopes apart from what we're actually being told by the scientists and by scientific consensus.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Of course. It was fun. Thanks, Charity.
Paul Strode is a high school science teacher in Boulder, Colorado. And Jim Hansen, thank you.
You all, thanks for having me.
Paul Strode is a high school science teacher in Colorado. Jim Hansen directs the program on climate science awareness and solutions at the Earth Institute at Columbia University. They'll both be part of Darwin Day in Iowa City this Friday and Saturday. Talk of Iowa continues in a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowa City's Darwin Day celebration is coming up this Friday and Saturday, February 23rd and 24th, a celebration of science and its contributions to humanity. And my next guest will be giving two presentations, one for scientists, negotiating public values when communicating controversial science, and one for the general public. Who doesn't believe in science? Ashley Landrum is an assistant professor of strategic science communication at Texas Tech University. Hello, Ashley.
Hello, Charity. How are you doing?
Very good. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Now, you study how people's deeply held values affect the processing of scientific information. And so in thinking about who doesn't believe in science, first, I'm curious, do you feel like trust in science is eroding? Is this an issue that is getting bigger right now?
I would say no. I don't believe that trust in science as a process is eroding. And spoiler alert, but the answer to who doesn't believe science is all of us. We all have times when we decide that we don't trust what science has to tell us. And the reason that we don't is when the information that they're giving us conflicts with our deeply held values.
Interesting. So even people who would say, yes, I believe science, you say we all have those moments. Can you give me an example of...
Yes. So a colleague of mine that I will not name, I don't want to embarrass him, but he and I are working on a project together with that's about evolution, and we also talk a lot about climate change. And he asks me, you know, well, I don't understand it. You know, religious people don't believe in evolution, and conservatives don't believe in climate change. And then I say, and you don't believe that GMOs are safe for human consumption. And he's like, well, that's different because that's the corporations, blah, 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 blah. And so we have, you know, everybody has the issue that they hear or what scientific evidence says that we will then contradict, or we say, well, no, that doesn't sound true to me given what I know either from my personal experience or what makes sense to me logically when I'm thinking about it. And we even see scientists do this. So many times when I come to give a presentation and I talk about, you know, among scientists, which I will at Darwin Day, about the knowledge deficit hypothesis. And that's the idea that if more people just knew the science, if they understood the science, they'd accept the science. And then I tell the scientists, no, that's not true. Actually, in many cases, particularly with climate change, the more people know, the more tightly held that belief is, the better that they are about arguing their point of view. So among Republicans who disbelieve climate change, we see that disbelief even stronger when they actually know a lot about climate change.
So if this is just the way that humans process information, and you don't believe that it's a bigger problem now than it has been before, is there something about our current situation that you believe is different? Because it feels, in my 43 years, like this is a bigger issue now. And maybe that's my own processing of information. But what do you think?
So one thing that has changed the way that we learn about this information is social media. Because for a long time, the way that science was sort of pushed around other scientific minds, a lot of this discussion was happening in academic journals. The public wasn't paying much attention to it, but you still had scientists fighting one another about different theories or saying what was probably true or not true. You know, there was pushback against Freud for his theory of psychoanalysis. Those sort of debates have always been happening, and now they're happening in the public sphere. So it's become easier for the public to become aware of what science has to say. But in addition to that, people in the general public can find other groups of people who believe the same things that they do, and then they just become sort of more emboldened and louder because they have a group consensus. So people within their identity group hold the same beliefs and values that they do. And as a group, they don't believe that this information is true. But the reason why I said that there's not, in my opinion, and from the data that I've seen, a distrust in science broadly decreasing is because people will always go and find their very own scientists who will say what they want them to say.
Well,
and that doesn't mean that the scientists are being paid to do this, but they believe the same thing they do.
Well, and you speaking of social media, I see posts all the time that are science-y. They're science-ish, but they're not science. They, you know, actually, you mentioned GMOs earlier. You can certainly find posts or articles that are written that sound like the scientific research says a certain thing. So is there more of that? I mean, I'm not going to use the term fake news to describe it, but is there more of that kind of propaganda or garbage science that gets passed around?
And again, and I think that has to do with, in some sense, the democratizing of knowledge and of news. As more people have access to their very own media platforms, it's not just public media, for example, that's airing these stories. It's not just New York Times that has articles. Anybody can jump on their computer and write a story. And in some cases, they're just blogging on their own page and they're not going to get a lot of traction. But in others, there are organizations that have sort of gained some ground. Naturalnews.com it has a bunch of propaganda on there about different things about vaccination and about climate change and about GMO that's completely wrong. But they have tons of followers and people who are really concerned about health and well-being and that are maybe a little bit, you know, afraid of chemicals, or they don't want to poison their bodies. And they start reading the information that's on there, and they assume that it's accurate. But again, when we take the power away from like these elite institutions that have been responsible for making sure that the content out in the world is credible, and we let everybody participate, we have the benefits of letting everybody participate in shared knowledge, as well as the negatives, which means that sometimes information that may be popular but not accurate is also going to spread virally, and that is problematic.
Well, of course, we all see the world through our values and our deeply held beliefs. Let's kind of break that down a little bit and talk about some of the categories for values and deeply held beliefs that may influence how we think about science. Let's talk about political ideology. In your research, is that something that seems to really skew a person's view of scientific research?
It is. And in particular, it has a lot to do when science meets policy. So if we look at what happens with climate change, for example, I mean, it makes a lot of sense that conservative and libertarian groups are going to be, you know, more hesitant to approve policies that use government regulation for things like climate change, right? They don't want the government regulating what the individual can do or what corporations can do. Well, while that makes sense to have these like heady sort of arguments about, well, how best do we mitigate against these huge environmental problems, it becomes easier to sort of condense that down into real or not real, right? So as we have more of this fake news spreading and we start talking about the influence of industry and other stakeholders in spreading different types of propaganda messages, then we start messages going around that are become skeptical of climate science, as opposed to having the argument about whether we should, to what extent we should be using government regulation versus economic or industry innovation, technological innovation to sort of tackle these big problems. So that can definitely influence the way, and I think climate change is the clearest example of where we've seen increasing polarization over time, to the point where even the word climate change or the word environment triggers people to jump into their ideological groups. And so people who are in the Senate or who are Democrat will vote yay for anything that talks about environment regulation, even if it doesn't make sense. And the conservatives will vote nay on anything that talks about environment, even if it does make sense. And that polarization has become really problematic in trying to push forward any types of policy that could be beneficial.
And you can point to what you really feel is the moment that climate change became political, became polarized in that way. When was that?
So some of my colleagues and I really do think that the 2000 election, the contentious election between Al Gore and George Bush that ended up going to the Supreme Court, really divided people when they look at one another about, you're a Republican, I'm a Democrat, like who's going to, you know, win this debate. And then when Al Gore went on to produce An Inconvenient Truth and to win a Nobel Prize for that, it became even more that climate change is considered a liberal issue. And so right now I'm at a university in the South, in the Southwest. It's very agricultural in this area, and we have tons of farmers who have told us and some of my colleagues that they're like, you know what, I see that climate change is an issue, but it is really hard for me to believe the same thing as Al Gore. And so whenever our political officials make something like this, these types of science issues a pet issue, it makes the politicization around that issue even worse sometimes. And so we jokingly refer to it as, like, you know, it's an inconvenient truth and then the inconvenient sequel, because we don't want that polarization to become any worse around climate change, particularly when we're starting to pull people back together on that as an issue.
So what you're saying also is that having more information, being climate literate, doesn't necessarily get you past the political polarization part of that. Like, you can have an understanding of the issue, but still reject it on the basis of your political ideology?
Yes. Yes. And we've shown that over and over again. It's a very robust finding. That conservatives who know more about science or more about climate change reject climate change that much more, because what we're finding is they're using their critical reasoning ability to justify their position more wholly. And so what we argue, what the goal really should be at this point, is trying, as scientists or as people in the community, as trying to show our friends and our neighbors that none of these issues are inconsistent with their identity groups. There's nothing about climate change as an issue that has to be at odds with Republican or with politically conservative values. And there are groups of people who are trying to really help with that. There's the website RepublicN. I don't know if you've seen that, where they're talking about free market solutions to addressing the problems with climate change. And the more that people are going out and saying, look, I'm a conservative, I recognize that climate change is an issue, and I believe that there are solutions that are consistent with conservative values to address this problem, I think that that's really going to help start bringing us together so we can actually work on how to solve the problem instead of fighting over whether or not it exists.
Well, and similarly, when we talk about religion, I mean, there are many people who reject evolution on the basis of their religious beliefs. But it sounds like you have a similar take, or we have a similar response as far as political ideology and facts in science or reports in science with religion and science. It doesn't necessarily mean that those two things can't coexist, but it does become polarized somehow, right?
Right. And I think a big problem is that as scientists, we want the public to think like we do. We want them to accept what we have to say. And a lot of my my friends, including my fiance, who's an evolutionary biologist, you know, they firmly believe that if you don't accept evolution as being 100% natural with no God involvement, no God needed, and in fact, you know, everybody should be atheists, that's exactly not the message that's going to help the general public who is somewhat religious or even very religious believe that evolution is true, because now you've made it a decision where they have to choose between their religion and accepting evolution. And what do you think they're going to pick? They're not going to pick the scientific information that you've just handed them. They're going to go with their deeply held worldview. That's something they're going to hold much, much closer. So instead, we have to show them how the two things can be compatible. I have an undergraduate research assistant in my lab who didn't know that it wasn't just sort of that the views that the public holds about evolution weren't just you believe in evolution or you are a complete creationist. He thought that he couldn't believe in evolution and be religious. And so I was telling him about what this paper that I did with Michael and Dina Weisberg and their student Emily Nentz. We were talking about how there are also deists and theists when it comes to evolution. And a deist is somebody who believes that God could have just started evolution and let it go from there. So it still kind of moves forward with natural processes, but doesn't require, you know, God to intervene. And then a theist says, well, yes, evolution happened, but, you know, God guides it, right? So it's guided by the hand of God. And both of those allow for God to take some sort of role in the process of evolution, but also for people to be able to believe that evolution is actually happening and over these mass scales, et cetera. So, and if we fight against that and say, no, you can't believe this, you have to believe in complete naturalistic evolution with no influence of God, we're going to end up losing some of our audience to people who are just going to reject that.
Right. What is your message to scientists or to journalists who cover science in communicating these ideas in a way that doesn't alienate people or doesn't trigger that ideological response?
Right. Well, so two main messages, right? The first is to really think about what your goals are. Do you just want to be contrary and tell people stuff that they're not going to like to hear and create that sort of fight or that argument? Or are you really trying to teach somebody and tell them about something that you think that is going to be relevant to their lives in some way? And if it's the latter, then what you need to do is show them in some ways how you share their values, right? What values do we share together? Catherine Hayhoe is a scientist at Texas Tech and a pretty famous climate communicator. And she was telling me about this time that she went to speak to a lodge in Lubbock about climate change. And these are individuals who would absolutely reject it. And what she did when she came in is she saw that they had in their lodge, they had a list of the core values of their organization. And she went through and rewrote her whole talk in like the 5 minutes before she gave it to show how acting to address climate change is consistent with those core values for that organization. And I think that that's what we really should be focused on, is show them how it doesn't have to be inconsistent with their identity. And we sort of like give science with a spoonful of sugar, you know what I mean? Help make it more digestible for the general public.
Well, Ashley Landrum, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Ashley Landrum is an assistant professor of strategic science communication at Texas Tech University. She'll be doing two presentations at Darwin Day in Iowa City, one for scientists negotiating public values when communicating controversial science, and one for the general public who doesn't believe in science. Darwin Day is coming up Friday and Saturday, February 23rd and 24th in Iowa City. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.